The Brides by Charlotte Cross, read by Sam Wolfe and Anna Popplewell. Prologue. It is my beloved, and yet not. It is some creature, wrong, twisted inside, made vile in a manner for which I do not have words. Her smile is not of warmth, but of some species of malice, of cruelty, of hunger. The green dress she wears, made for a woman long dead, in an era long past, fits her like snakeskin. "Come here, my love," she whispers in her siren's voice. "Come to me and kiss me, and we will be together forever." She moves closer, holding out her cold white hand. "Is this not what you have always wanted? Come to me and be mine for eternity."
Part 1. Sir John Seward's Personal Diary. Monday, 5th of January, 1903. Littlemore Hospital, Oxfordshire. Sitting in the train, I gazed out of the window and allowed my mind to wander. The hills rolled by, gentle raindrops ran down the glass, and the rhythm of the wheels lulled me into a half-doze. Slowly, from nowhere at all, I began to feel a prickling of unease. It was of a kind which would have been familiar to our distant ancestors, those poor brutes who in such early days were still prey to beasts more vicious than themselves. The feeling grew and grew until I was almost nauseous with it. Gradually, so gradually, a mist appeared on the very edge of my field of vision. I felt I sensed rather than saw it coalescing. From the corner of my eye, I caught a glimpse of a familiar long, pale face. My heart began to pound, my head turned of its own volition, and at last I saw him, fixing me with his cold red stare through the glass of the compartment door. A hideous smile stretched to breaking point across his ghastly visage, flashing those brilliant, sharp white teeth. Carefully, deliberately, never taking his eyes from mine, he reached for the door handle. I awoke with a start at the sound of the guard announcing my stop. I hurried on my Ulster coat and my new bowler hat, still a little too tight, and tried to shake off the nightmare which has dogged me in various guises for almost a decade. As ever, I had little success. It was cold and damp when I stepped off the train at Littlemore Railway Station. I was the only passenger to alight. I wondered for the thousandth time if I had made the right choice in accepting this post, but I couldn't stay in Essex with my memories forever. I crossed over the footbridge to the lodge carrying only my valise, my trunks having been sent on ahead. Before me, the asylum buildings seemed to vanish away into the mist. Their butter-coloured Cotswold stone and overhanging eaves were no longer so pleasing to the eye as they had been on my previous visit in the warm autumn glow of late September. I presented my letters of introduction to the guard at the gatehouse. He signed me in with a "Welcome, Governor," and handed me off to a stout orderly to show me to my new home. The orderly, Burton, informed me that he had orders to take me to Deputy Director Knight at my earliest convenience. There being no time like the present, I declined the opportunity to deposit my valise with my new housekeeper and followed Burton across to the main building. After quite a climb to the top floor, during which I rather regretted my decision to keep hold of my valise, Burton shepherded me down a long corridor before stopping suddenly outside a door bearing the legend "Deputy Director." I briefly wondered where my own office might be, but Burton was already propelling me through the door before I could catch my breath to ask. The room beyond was bright and airy. Tall windows looked out to the north, showing the university's dreaming spires poking upwards out of the mist. Only 3 miles separate the asylum from Oxford's hallowed halls of learning, but it might as well be 300. Floor-to-ceiling bookshelves lined the walls, excepting where a newfangled filing cabinet squatted in a corner next to an empty hat stand. My deputy was seated behind a grand mahogany desk, studying a patient's file. "Sir John," she said,